Hey guys, my name's Nick. I'm an alcoholic. A lot of people. You're all naked. Let's give it up for David again, man. That was. I don't want to have to follow you, really. I got drunk a lot. Fucked shit up real good, and then I got sober. My sobriety date is March 18th of 2009. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. I have a home group. I'm heavily involved in service work. I love my life today. That wasn't something I could say before I got sober. I don't really ever remember enjoying life, looking back on my time before sobriety. The only enjoyment that I got was out of a bottle or some sort of other substance. And that was usually short-lived because I woke up in places that I didn't want to be or remembering things that I didn't mean to do or the same story, ad infinitum. From my earliest memories, I could tell you that I was angry, irritable, and discontent. I felt like from an early age, I'd been dealt a shitty hand. I'd just been dealt a really bad hand. I had a younger sister that got more attention than me, and my parents, they were okay, but they weren't great. And I was born to a young Navy couple, and the geographical cure was embedded in me pretty early. I remember even at an early age, like really looking forward to picking up and going somewhere else and becoming someone different. And I remember that being a stark contrast to me and my sister. My sister, she would like get really upset about having to go and try to make new friends somewhere else. Me, I was, I usually got to that point even at a young age where, I'd grown bored of the people that I was hanging out with. I'd use them for whatever I could use them for, juice boxes or toys or whatever. I was ready to go be someone different in a different place. At 10 years old, I was living in California, and my grandfather died. That was my mother's father, and he was an alcoholic. He was an orphan in the Great Depression. He was a vet of three wars. In my mind, anybody that had the life that he had would probably end up alcoholic too. At least what I knew of alcoholism at 10 years old, and. When I say he died, he took his own life. He put a gun in his mouth and shot himself in front of my grandmother. And, at 10 years old, that was something that was hard for me to comprehend. All I knew is that it affected me poorly. What I know now is that the things that went on, when I was a kid that happened around me, I kind of took on as something that happened directly to me. Being the oldest, I had two younger sisters at this point. Being the oldest, my mother and I were the only ones that flew back to Connecticut from California for my grandfather's funeral. And I remember there being a lot of people. It seemed like the whole sleepy town of Guilford, Connecticut came to this funeral. And people seemed really broken up, and I was just really mad. I was just really upset. How could this happen to me, the way I felt. My dad, when we got back, kind of worked out a transfer to Connecticut. Shortly thereafter, my dad left. So I was left with my two sisters and my mother. And just an angry kid, man. My parents had broken up. My grandfather was dead. And, my mom was left to kind of pick up the pieces. And I felt like I was too. And so I found some kids that were like me, that were from single parent homes or broken homes, if you will, and that like to do the stuff I was into, and that was cause trouble. I got into a lot of fights from the earliest I could remember. I spoke with a speech impediment. I couldn't pronounce my S's. I talk like this. It's really easy for me to revert back to. And I was also ADHD, so I couldn't come back when somebody would say something, so I just punch him in the head. And at 11 years old, I had a buddy that had an older brother that could get beer, and And he got us a 30-pack. Up in Connecticut, they have 30 packs. And we split them up. I took 15 in my backpack. He took 15 in his. And we walked a few miles to another buddy's house where four of us proceeded to drink like pigs. I mean, I drank about six or seven beers in the course of an hour. And I was in love. At 11 years old, I had found what I had been looking for, you know. I just remember thinking, like, man, why couldn't this have happened earlier? You know, like, this is what I needed. This is what I needed the whole time. And my sponsor says it best, and he got it from someone else, who I'm sure got it from someone else. But, you know, my toes uncurled. You know, when I drank that first beer, you know, I felt the release. You know, the tension out of my shoulders left, and I was able to take a deep breath and kind of look people in the eye and feel okay. We thought it was a bright idea to walk down the street about a mile and a half to a girl's house. And on the way, I decided that it would be a good idea to rip off every mailbox on the way down there. And I did. If I couldn't rip it off the post, I uprooted it and threw it in the yard. I was Superman. And so I did that. And then we got kicked out of the girl's house, you know, a bunch of drunk 11, 12, 13-year-olds, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning. Not a recipe for success. And so on the way back, a cop pulled up, and I was smashed. I smoked weed for the first time that night, so I was nice. And I decided it was a good idea to dive in the gravel behind my friends, and he was like, well, I guess I know who I'm taking to jail. So my first time drunk, I was one for one. I got arrested. My mom had to come pick me up at our sleepy little jail cell. I think there was like two jail cells in East Lyme, Connecticut. 3 o'clock in the morning, and she grounded me for 2 weeks. And I remember during that 2 weeks, the only thing I could think about was the next time I got to get drunk. I mean, literally, that was all I thought about. You know, I was just up my mom's ass, like, yo, let me out, let me out, let me out. And I think she let me out about a week and a half for bad behavior. And and I got with that same buddy, my boy Aaron, and he got us another 30 pack, and we got drunk again. And I got arrested again. So at 11 years old, I had gotten drunk twice, and I'd been arrested twice. You know, and that was okay. Like I said, man, drinking wasn't a problem for me. It never was. It was an absolute solution to who and what I was, and to you and circumstances and everything else that went along with it. You know, at an early age, I would tell people, like, I'm gonna die before I'm 30. It's okay, you know. And before I came here, every time I said that, people were like, "What?" And I'm just like, "Yeah, I'm drunk, man. I want to drink until the wheels fall off, you know." And that was the deal for me, you know. And I did pretty much. I was what you call a garbage head. I don't know if you guys know that term, but pretty much anything that got put in front of me, I would do. You know, I would do it first and ask questions later. If they told me it would mess me up, I would do it. You know, I started doing like acid when I was 12 years old, and you know, I was just I didn't really care, you know. And, you know, I was a smart kid. You know, I was in all honors classes, and, you know, I was athletic. I played football, basketball, and baseball. And, you know, my high school career, I got kicked off the baseball team twice. You know, my junior year, got kicked off of varsity, went out for it again, worked out real hard, got on, and got it over another guy that made the team in my spot, basically, or was a reserve, and then I got kicked off again. So I was a classic waste of potential, basically, is what they used to say. You know, I remember my graduation. I thought this was awesome, but you know, I barely graduated. Graduated by the skin of my teeth, and really, I just think they wanted to get rid of me. You know, I was in mandatory anger management classes all 4 years of high school, and you know, I was always in fights and always disrupting class, and just, you know, I was a nuisance, a menace, you know, and because I wanted to be, you know, I did everything I could to get attention, you know, good, bad, or other. And you know, at my graduation, I remember, you know, they did it alphabetically, so when it got close, you know, I had friends, I had people that liked me, you know, like me being around, and people started cheering when it got closer to my name. And and I remember the principal hushing everybody down and being like, okay, everybody, Nick's been waiting for this for a long time, and getting a big laugh out of everybody. And I thought it was really cool, man. You know, I got the attention I deserved. you know, looking back, that's not very cool, man. You know, like everybody knowing that you're a fuck up and you being the last one to know. You know, I graduated barely and thought it was a good idea to get out. I've been in Connecticut now for far too long. It was like 7.5 years, you know, of, you know, burning bridges and you know, close calls and everything else that goes with it. And I moved down to North Carolina where my dad was, and I got my first DUI shortly thereafter. You know, and I could tell you about the different places I moved. I moved to Chicago for a year and a half with a girl that worked for me. I found telemarketing. I found sales because sales used my best attribute, and that was my manipulative nature. You know, I could lie like the best of them, and it was better if you weren't in front of me, you know, because it was easier if I had to hang up the phone. They promoted me, man. I was managing my own telemarketing room inside of 6 months, and you know, I remember the best part about sales was that I could make the money I needed, and that if I showed up still drunk from the night before, they would usually tell me to go to the bathroom, clean myself up, and produce. You know, as long as I produced, they would keep me around, and that was cool. You know. Like I said, I moved to Chicago with a girlfriend that worked for me. I don't think I was really invited. I think I just kind of, oh, you're going to Chicago? Yeah, I'll go to Chicago. That's cool. I burned enough bridges here. And Chicago is cool, apparently. I spent a year and a half there. I couldn't really tell you a whole lot about it. Like, people are like, oh, you live in Chicago. That's a pretty cool city. And I'm like, yeah, I guess. I mean, I was there for a year and a half. I was either drinking or working, and usually drunk while I was at work. So I went door to door for a year and a half, which I wouldn't suggest. Especially in Chicago in the Midwest, a lot of grimy areas and it gets really cold there. I don't know if you guys have been up there, but not the best. So I moved down here. A guy that used to work for me came down here and got a good job, and he called me up and offered me a job. It was perfect because, again, man, my stays in certain places had begun to get shorter. You know, Chicago was it was about that time. You know, enough burned bridges that I literally left like a thief in the night. You know, I packed up everything in my Jeep and drove out at like midnight, you know, without a forwarding address. You know, I moved down to Florida. I think it was about 10 years ago. Timelines are a little wavy still. But yeah, I had a great job. And I have to tell you about my first apartment. My first year down here, I was working for Verizon selling Yellow Page ads, 22 years old. And I made $87,000 my first year, and I lived in a one-bedroom apartment in Pinellas Park with an air mattress, a milk crate, and a 13-inch television. My kitchen was a trash. It was a landfill, basically. Like, I would throw empty bottles and beer cans and take out in there, you know. And I would bring girls home, like, make yourself comfortable. I got an air mattress. Crazy, but that's unmanageability, and I didn't know it at the time. But you know, if you're making, you know, $87,000 and you can't furnish an apartment, a one bedroom, 550 square foot apartment, then you got problems, you know. And I probably would have gone a lot longer without furniture, but somebody that I worked with came over unannounced and saw the way I was living, and literally said, you know what, I was gonna buy new furniture, get a U-Haul, come grab my stuff and put it in your place, and I did. So I was a real, real adult. I got my second DUI in 07. You know, this time it was a lot worse. The first time it was, you know, nothing. I was on a naval base. I couldn't drive on base for 6 months. That means I could drive up to the front and park and then walk on and then walk off and drive away. I got off pretty easy. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's the way it went. And this time I wrapped my pole around a car, a telephone pole. Yeah. What did I say? What did I wrap around? Yeah, a pole around a car. Yeah, that's exactly the way it worked. Actually, it was the way it worked. The car was, yeah, somewhere in there. If you saw the car, you wouldn't think anybody walked away. I did. I had a bruised wrist and a bruised sternum. My passenger also walked away, and I didn't recognize that as maybe an act of providence. Maybe a little grace being shown in my life. The whole front end of my car was gone. The engine was basically in my lap. You know, it was in the front seat, went through the dash. And when I say I walked away, like, they took me to the hospital in an ambulance, and they kicked me out of the hospital the next morning because I woke up drunk, ripping cords out and belligerent. And I kind of stuck my head in the sand, and then I kind of figured, since I didn't know where my car was and I didn't know where my wallet was, and this was like a couple months after, that I probably had a court date. So I found a lawyer, and he was like, yeah, you actually have court in about a week. Yeah, I went to court, and I made good money at the time, so I threw some money at him, and he got it reduced down to, you know, whatever you could get it reduced down to. And I paid for the, I paid for all the stuff that goes along with it, and I thought it was a good opportunity to prove to myself and to everybody else that I didn't have a problem. So I stopped drinking. And when I say I stopped drinking, for 6 months I would drink anywhere between 18 and 24 O'Douls a day. Which, if you've ever drank O'Douls in that capacity, like, that's enough to almost catch a buzz, like, to really piss you off, like, if you're an alcoholic like I am. So it was really crazy. But I did. I got through everything, and then I had gotten a girlfriend during my sober period, my dry period. We went up to Minnesota for the 4th of July. That's where she was from. Parents had a lake house, and they were like, man, you've gone 6 months without drinking. You could probably have a couple, you know, for the 4th of July, the festivities. And, you know, I was like, you know what? You're right, man. I'm almost out of the woods. I'm good. And I did, man. I had a couple drinks, a couple margaritas. We watched the fireworks. You know, we didn't have any knockdown, drag-out fights. You know, I caught a buzz. Everything was cool, man. I was good. About a month later, I was at a Rays game. I'm a Red Sox fan. So, yeah. And I was at a Red Sox Rays game, and you know, I got really drunk and got into a fight with some Rays fans, got kicked out, decided it was a good idea to talk shit to cops and you know, push them off me and everything. You know, no big deal. They don't like that. And so I got taken. Attaboy, I like that. I got taken to 49th Street and strapped down in the bad boy chair. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but it's a hard plastic molded chair with like 5 seat belts that they strap you in as tight as they can. So, you know, that's where my drinking went. You know, like, my alcoholism wasn't waiting around for me. It was full steam ahead. Didn't matter if I was 6 months without a drink or, you know, and what I realize now is it doesn't matter if 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You know, it's full steam ahead. I kept drinking. You know, I threw some more money at my lawyer. Had to write a letter to Ferg's. I was outside of Ferg's, whatever. I now play softball on the Ferg softball team, which is kind of crazy. They banned me for life, and now I play softball for them. I don't know if they know it's me. I don't hang out there, but just play softball. Yeah, so I wrote a letter to the cop that had to get stitches in his shoulder for falling down or whatever, and to the owner of Ferg's, and, you know, I got out of it. And everything was cool, man. I kept drinking because alcohol kept doing for me what I wanted it to do. It held up its end of the bargain. So it didn't really matter what the consequences were. And, you know, I wasn't spending long stints in jail, you know, just a couple days at a time, you know, for stupid shit like pissing in public or, you know, pushing a cop off you or whatever, DUI. You know, but what's crazy is alcohol worked so well for me for so long, you know, that when it stopped working, a couple months before I got sober, I had absolutely no recourse. I had no solution to handling life. And when I say it stopped working, you know, I would drink like 4 or 5 beers and black out and not remember a thing, or drink as much as I could and not get drunk or get drunk from the neck down. It was absolute hell, you know. I'd wake up in the morning hating myself more than I did the day before, telling myself there's no way you could hate yourself more than you do right now, and waking up the next day hating myself more than I did then. And like I said, for someone who's selfish and self-centered like me, that's a really shitty place without a solution. You know, and I didn't have it. You know, luckily for me, my father had gone into AA in 07. You know, and it sent me a big book, same big book I have today. It says, I love you, Dad, August of 07. That was 2 months after he got sober. And it's still the same big book I have today. You know, it went directly under the bed. I never even cracked the binding, but, you know, I had it, And I knew where the rooms were because I went to a couple required meetings when I had been sober before, drinking O'Doul's. And, you know, there was one of two things. I could either, you know, humble myself enough to walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on my own volition, or put a gun in my mouth, you know. And luckily for me, you know, I can't imagine the world without me in it. It's funny, right? It's fucking true. I mean, it's like, you don't even know me, and what would you do if, you know, you didn't get the opportunity to meet me? I mean, like, that's how selfish I was, and that works for me. So I, you know, my last drunk was March 17th, St. Patrick's Day of 2009, and it was just a regular night, man. You know, like, I had a couple drinks, I had a couple more, and I blacked out. You know, I drank until I passed out, you know. And I woke up the next day, you know, bleary-eyed and feeling the same way. And I didn't know it was a different day. You know, I had met a buddy that I used to get drunk with when I went to those three required meetings, and he'd give me his number, you know. I mean, no big deal. For some reason, I kept it, and I called him, and I said, hey, are you still going to those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings? He said, yeah, why don't you meet me there at 5:30, and I did. And I remember the stark difference between when I went to those required meetings not having a problem and when I came here under my own volition, and it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. You know, the people in the room knew who I was and what I was about without me saying a thing, you know, and that's a scary thing for me, you know, because I'd worked really hard at hiding who and what I was. You know, and you know, I was desperate. I was blessed with the gift of desperation, and I didn't know what that meant. You know, all I knew is that before I came into AA, if you told me to do something or asked me to do something, you better have a real good reason for why I'm doing it, you know, or I'm not going to do it. That was the long and short of it. You know, kick rocks. I don't, you know, if you're not going to give me something or if I'm not going to get something in return, forget about it. You know, and for the first time in my life, I was willing to do things without somebody telling me explicitly what it was that I was going to get out of it, you know. And I did, man. People told me, get a home group, do 90 meetings in 90 days, read the first 164 pages of the big book, get a sponsor, get a commitment, you know. Don't mess with girls in your first year. You know, I did all those things because I was desperate, man. I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. I didn't want to go back to where I was, you know, and I'd like to say my first year was hard. It wasn't. It wasn't. I just did what I was told. You know, I put my head down and did what I was told. At 30 days sober, I remember I was going to a meeting after work, and my father called me. And he was like, you know, I wanted to call and congratulate you on 30 days. You know, I'm sure you're going to a meeting. Where are you going? And kind of talked to me about it. And he reminded me of my grandfather. He was like, you remember your granddad? And I was like, yeah. He's like, your mom's dad? I was like, yeah. And he's like, you know, he was an alcoholic. And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, he was sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 and a half years. And I said, no, I didn't know that. He said, yeah. He goes, he went back out. And, you know, within a couple months, you know what happened. And I said, yeah, I know what happened. You know, because at that point, I had a good job. I had never been to detox. I had never been to rehab. My stays in jail had only been short. I had a girlfriend at the time. You know, I didn't have the unmanageability, or I didn't see it, you know, and it all came into focus at that point. You know, it was, you know, nothing in God's economy is wasted. You know, everything has its place. And, you know, for a long time, you know, my grandfather and my father leaving and all those things were catalysts for me being who I was, or that's the way I looked at it. And you know, today, my grandfather didn't have to die in vain, you know, because it's like, that's my story. You know, I don't know if I'll put a gun in my mouth, but I know that if I drink, I'll die. You know, like David said, you know, to drink today is to die, you know. And I wouldn't be lucky enough for it to happen tomorrow. You know, I'd end up 70 years old, pissy pants on the side of the road with two pennies to rub together, with nobody to call, you know, and that would be my story. You know, the steps saved my life. You know, AA saved my life, and my higher power saved my life. I like to say I'm comfortably agnostic, and that's not a dirty word. You know, I believe strongly. I'm a very spiritual person. I wake up in the morning and I ask for help, and I thank my higher power at night if I stayed sober that day. And I've been able to do that for almost 5 years now. But I don't know who it is. I don't know what it is. It doesn't really matter to me. Like, it works in my life when I ask for the help. I'm blessed with men in my life that I get to take through the steps, show the way it was shown to me, and that'll hopefully get an opportunity to do the same. You know, I get to coordinate meetings at treatment facilities. I'm the coordinator for Bridging the Gap. I have been for a few years now over in Pinellas. And, you know, I get to do those things to get myself outside of myself. Because, you know, left to my own devices, I think about myself almost exclusively. And that's a really bad place for me. Because, you know, Nick's Nick is an asshole. You know, God's Nick is an asset to the people around him and to himself. And, you know, I don't like to talk in the third person, but I don't know a better way to state it. You know, like, that's just the truth. You know, I work at a place that's, you know, a coveted position, you know, with, you know, and they're looking at me as a leader. It's mind-boggling to me, you know, and I'm grateful for the life I'm given today, the opportunities that I have today, the opportunity to come and talk to you guys, because, you know, like, I don't know if anybody's going to stay sober based on what I said tonight, but I know I am, you know, and that's all I can really ask for. You know, I never got sober for anybody else. You know, I got sober for me, and I live a life beyond my wildest dreams, and like I said at the beginning, you know, I didn't know happiness until I came here, and today I do. You know, I don't look too far ahead, and I don't look back too far. You know, I focus on the here and now, and you know, for that I'm grateful. Thanks for listening.